Good evening, and can you tell me your name, please?
Edward Watts.
And please, can you state where you were born?
I was born in Newport. And to be precise, Phil Gwynthley.
And when were you born?
On the 5th of December 1948.
And can you tell me when your father was born?
No idea.
No. And can you tell me where your father grew up?
South Shields.
And your father was born in South Shields?
Yes.
Can you tell me who he lived with in South Shields?
With his mother and father.
And do you know the origin of where they came from?
They were from the West Indies.
And you describe your father's country of origin, you know, as?
His country. And because it was his country and I was always going to visit it sooner, and I still haven't.
So your father was living in South Shields. He was born in South Shields and had West Indian parents. And can you tell me when he came to Newport?
I can't tell you when he came to Newport. I can tell you how he came to Newport. He went to sea, him and his brother. He was on a ship my grandfather was on, because my grandfather went to sea, my mother's father, and they docked in Newport, and since it was a Newport ship, basically, they all went home, so it left him there on his own on board, and my grandfather said, oh, come on, you can come home with me, and he came home with my grandfather. Met my mother, and as they say, the rest is history, really. It sort of went from there. They kept in touch and eventually got married, and then in 1948 I turned up.
So do you remember or have any childhood memories about growing up and where you lived?
I lived in Pill, and growing up in Pill, most people would of my age would know that Pill was very much a microcosm. You had everything you wanted in Pill. You had the butchers, you had Green Harpers, the greengrocers, and in Harpers you got fruit and veg, you got fish stalls, you had Jim Grayson's, who was a butcher, you had Basham's, which was a haberdashery, everything you wanted was in Pill. So if you like, once you pass over Cardiff Road from coming uptown, everything was in Pill, and it was a very vibrant, very close community, which eventually got destroyed by them knocking down streets and turning into the rabbit warren that they've got there now, where they moved people out to Ringland and all over the place, and then the council had some bright idea that bringing families who were problem families into areas where there was a good community, that it would bring them up. Well, that experiment never worked. So yeah, Pill, I mean, I can remember in Pill, if I went to the Capitol Cinema, which most people wouldn't even recognise now, but it's sort of John Frost, the sort of sovereign arcade, as we used to call it, and that area, which is now Friars Walk, was the Capitol Cinema, and you had the fire station next door. But if you went up the Capitol and you walked home, you walked down through Pill past the Irish Club, and people would, what time do you call this, get home? Same on the Sunday, if you know, you'd have the priest, Father Barry, and you'd have Father Davis from over St. Stephen's, and they'd go around collecting the kids for Sunday school or for catechism, or they were going to Boys Brigade and all the rest. It was all very it was very much a community. I mean, if somebody died, someone would go around the streets and collect for a wreath or collect money or clothing if they were really struggling. If someone was ill, somebody would always make food and take it out. Everybody, my mum, my gran, first thing in the morning would go out and scrub the paving stones in front of the house. And that was Pill.
Would you say the culture was diverse in Pill when you were growing up?
Totally. And the difference being, nobody worried about it. Well, my grandfather was 6 foot three. Mr. Cooper, they used to go, you know, Mr. Cooper, and he was in the bus. Let's see if I remember the bus. Royal Antediluvian Association of Buffaloes. And he was Grand Primo and all the rest of it. You know, I mean, Grand Primo was like the senior buffalo. But it was totally multicultural. It was because it was a seafaring community. I mean, everybody down there had somebody who went to sea, basically. So we had loads in common. And it was very much very, very close. And it sounds really, thinking about it, it sounds sort of stupid, but it also felt safe. Because nobody worried. I mean, people of mixed race, which they weren't called mixed race then, but nobody stopped to think about. I dare say there was racism, if you like. You can always go back and get racism from either side. But I can remember Pill changing when they started, when the. I'm useless at dates because time goes so fast, and when you get to my age, you forget the time. But the you know, when they started knocking down bits of Pill and all the rest of it, and moving people in, and the Pill people, if you like, moved out, that's when it all started to change. And then you started to get some racism because you were getting people coming from other parts of the town who perhaps didn't understand the Pill culture, if you like. Because Pill was very, very, very precise. You, from Rupera Street on down, you knew right down to Alexander Road, where you knew a lot of Irish families lived. So it was, if you like, I don't mean zone, but there was very clear areas everybody lived. And that all culminated in everybody knowing everybody else's business, or running the backs. I mean, if you were late coming home, you would run the backs, what we call run the backs. You wouldn't, you know, instead of going all around the streets, you run the backs, which was part and parcel. It was good fun. It was good fun. I mean, the high day and holidays was going to Barry Island with the Labour Hall, and that they would have down James Street and all the rest of it. You would have all the red and white coaches. It used to be red and white in those days, Western Welsh and red and white, and you'd have all of them, 30 odd buses, and everybody go to Barry for the day. But and then you'd end up with kids who you didn't even know, but their parents couldn't go with them or something, and you take up, and you know, it was a good life coming up. It was a good life coming up to a point, as with everything.
So you mentioned that Pill was very community based.
Oh, totally.
Togetherness, inclusive.
Yeah.
And everybody, you know, got along regardless.
Yep.
What about the wider UK?
Oh, the wider UK, as I just said recently, when I started, I mean, my grandfather had, I mean, we went through they had race problem war, really, in Newport at one stage, which was, and I seen the smattering that with people spitting at my grandfather and us, When I was coming up, I had my car set on fire because I had a decent, my parents saved up and got me, I had a decent car, and they said try setting fire to it. We had extra shit put through the door when certain people moved into the street, and they were druggies to start off with, but they didn't. Things like when I went to start to work for, I won't mention the name of the grocery company, but it was a major grocery company. I can remember being my mum ringing me up and saying, "Can you get home straight away?" The police had come and raid a house, and they were in my house. And when I got the house, my father sat on the stairs with these white police officers, sort of shooting their mouths off, and my mother said, "This is my son." And I always remember this guy turning around, it was Regional Crime Squad, turning around and saying, "Well, you all look alike. So how do I know?" And then all the neighbours around by us were coming and saying, "Well, they're taking all the ones they wanted with three doors down," and they were taking out in the van, but he had, as far as he was concerned, it had to be us because we were black. It couldn't be the white ones three doors down. And I always remember going down to Pill Police Station and seeing the chief inspector down there at the time, drink water. And he turned around and said, and I don't want his name for it, by the way, turning around and saying to me, "Oh, well, you know, it's your word against theirs." As I said, but also when I started work, I went for a job over the steelworks, and the guy was talking pidgin English to me, but I thought he had an impediment in his speech, so I was trying to talk slower because I really couldn't get what he was trying to say, and as far as he was concerned, I was black or coloured then. It wasn't you were black, I was coloured, and therefore probably didn't understand English, so he spoke pidgin English to me. And there was me thinking, "Oh, the poor guy's got an impediment in his speech." And so that was the end of that job. And as I said as well, I was going to join the police, and the chief at the time I think it was Ron Boyle, was the head of British Transport Police, they came and told me, "One day we'll have black people or coloured people in the police force. Today, that's not today, and not likely to be in the near future." So, you know, so I went through all of that, and it was very much, even when I started work, I was not allowed in the store for 3 months. So they paid me, but I wasn't allowed in the store for 3 months, where they had a meeting to decide whether having somebody like me in the store might upset the customers touching their food. So when I started, I think the first, they had the big Robinson's Golly, because at those times you had Robinson's Gollies, which you saved up for and you got a golly badge. But they had POS there, point of service, point of sale stuff, and written over the golly, "Go home." I was not allowed to eat in the canteen because I might contaminate the knives and forks, so I used to eat in the Sovereign Arcade, which was underground, because I was on good scene. So I used to eat down there. But I had to come in before the store opened and leave after the store closed, because there was opening and shutting hours in those days. And, you know, I went home and said, "I don't like it there." And my mother turned around and saying, "Well, if you're going to let them best you, they're an honest son of mine, you'll best them." And my father turned around and said, "Come on, that's it, you know." And I remember my mother coming up and saying to the manager up there, "You can do what you like, but he ain't going anywhere." So, you know, because my parents never, ever, ever had a holiday. Everything, because I'm dyslexic. Well, I know I am now, but in those days, it was not sort of as well known. You were thick. So as far as they were concerned, they worked every single hour and every single halfpenny to actually make me, well, to ensure that I had a good life, and you know, everything I am today was down to them. Every honour that I've received is down to them. So, yeah, I mean, even in school, I ended up going to a private school. And they were talking about the Caribbean and slavery. And the one teacher, every time they talked about that, she would always call me out to the front of the class. And these are the sort of people we used to have who would be serving us. And when they used to have the sort of biopics, you know, sort of things like well, you can be the slave. And things like that, you know, it was quite bizarre. So that that was something else. I think through my life, you get racism, which is overt racism and in your face racism, and you get jealousy racism. Jealousy racism is probably in some way worse, because they'll have a go at you because you're black and you've achieved, and they don't like that, and that drives this hatred. And causes that animosity, and that's for me that's the worst part, because you can't fight that. I think the law doesn't help as well, because when they brought in the Race Relations Act and all the rest of it, where you could confront it and hit it head on, it all went underground because everybody was, if you like political correctness. Now, for me, the N word is, I mean, I was called it enough when I was a kid and growing up, and my mother, my father, my grandfather, because my grandmother was white, so she wasn't. But we all went through the N word. And it really beats me when you get the very people who decry everything in the States using the N word with every second. And to me, it really grates. You know, we fought to stop that. And yet, and the very place where Black Lives Matter, they're using it as a badge. And for me, that's not a badge. But that's me. I mean, at my age, I suppose I get away with being old and cynical. But that's not a badge for me. I mean, somebody calls me by the N word, I wouldn't appreciate it. I suppose I've been, depends which way you want to look at it, because my grandmother was white, so there was all my Cornish family. My grandfather was from the States. I met them, or some of them, when they came across from the States. My father, as I said, I used to say, I want to go and see your country sometime, because for me, talking about South Shields was the other end of the world. You know, it's up there somewhere, you know. And sometimes he did have some visitors from South Shields. And my mother used to turn around and say, oh, go and get the phrase book, because we need the phrase book now to understand what they're saying, because with a, where are you, pet? And all the rest of it. And it's like really broad Geordie. And he'd be sat there and I'd just nod and smile and all the rest of it. And of course my father then was immediately, with his friends from up there, his Geordie accent would come on full belt. But he was a great cook, my father. He went to sea as a cook. He worked in Howard Tennant's down on the dock. He worked for Atlantic Shipping. Worked for Whitehead's as a crane driver, you know, I mean, they worked hard. I mean, and in those days as well, coming up as a kid, which a lot of youngsters, when you hear them going on about, oh, they're deprived because they can't get the latest sort of kit that's on telly, you know, I mean, we lived in, the three of us lived in a room and with my father's motorbike, because we, there was only, you know, we had to keep them, there was nowhere to put the motorbike, so it was in the room with us. My mother ripped off wallpaper behind the cooker to use as a sort of scribble board for me, to, you know, to learn. As I said, being dyslexic, it was really hard going. What helped me a lot was I loved King Arthur and Knights of the Round Table. So that helped me with my reading, because I could match up the pictures with the words. So, yeah, so, but then, as I said, as I leap about in this little world of mine, coming up through Pearl, it was good. My Auntie May, most people knew my Auntie May because she was a lady of the town, along with Big Bet, who was another lady of the town. But not like when I say ladies of the town or ladies of the night, it was a whole different ball game. But it was, you know, I don't know if you say respectable, but I think there was respect, because it wasn't like in your face, you know. You know, my Auntie May was my Auntie May. She was my mother's stepsister, because my gran had married before. But my Auntie May was wonderful. You know, she was part of the family. My Uncle Gordon, who was adopted, he was white, but they got, he was, how Gordon came about was because he was, his parents had locked him in underneath the stairs, and my gran and my mother went and got him out of there, because they weren't feeding him and all the rest of it, because they didn't want the kid. The father went off to Australia and all that. Anyway, that's another story. But so coming up, I mean, when I went to work, when I was actually working for the company that I was working for and progressed, there was a lot of racism. And then I got to a stage where I was, went on to, became a trustee and went on to the pension board. And in our head office, there was obviously a dining room. I walked in the dining room, two of the directors, main board directors, turned around and said, "I'm not eating with somebody from the colonies." And I turned around and said, "Excuse me, Wales, I'm from Wales, and Wales is a principality, it's not a colony." So that was the end of that conversation. And I got to be fair, Lord so-and-so actually took them to task, in fairness. The chair of the pension funds said, "You know, we've got you. We would like you to join because of the work you've done." And when I retired from that, I think one of the nicest things, I've had some nice things said to me in my years, but he turned around and said, "I don't know about every little else, but you have definitely, I can say, would always make this company honest." Which I thought was nice. And I've been lucky enough in my years to meet people like Nelson Mandela. Met him because I was, when coming up through the company I was working for, I became a shop steward before I ever got up to the dizzy heights of being on the pension board. But I met him because of the union, and I met him again when I went to South Africa on business. He gave me a most outlandish shirt, which, to be perfectly honest with you, was absolutely unbelievable. It had more colours than Joseph in his Technicolour dream coat. But he didn't laugh as such. He laughed through his eyes, and the tears had been going down his face. he turned around and said, I always remember he turned around and saying to me, you need to get out in the sun a bit more, son. And I'm like, yeah, I know. But it was, that was great. You know, and over the years with the Mission to Seafarers, because I'm chairman of the Mission to Seafarers, and I've been down the Mission to Seafarers now 55, 56 years. So I've met seafarers from all around the world. A huge learning curve, a huge thing that I'm grateful for, because I've met so many people, heard so many stories. Love the Filipinos because they're so much fun and they're so happy. No matter how bad things are, they're so really happy. And I've done that. I've been lucky enough to have an MBE, lucky enough to be a Deputy Lieutenant at Gwent, lucky enough to vet probably most of the Royal Family. The main ones being Princess Anne, because Princess Anne had been down to the Mission quite a few times, and she very kindly came down to give me my 50-year presentation. She decided she was going to do that. And it was quite funny, because when I got my MBE, they sort of said, Mr. Edward Watts for his work with the Mission to Seafarers, scouting and community cohesion throughout South Wales. And she swung around, looked, and she turned around and said, what am I? Because she's president of the Mission to Seafarers. You know, so yeah, wonderful lady, wonderful lady. And then the other thing I'm very proud of is prior to Her Majesty's demise was the Jubilee. And someone had suggested to me about having a pigeon race. And I put that to the Lord Lieutenant and said, oh, that's interesting. Let's write it up. So I wrote it up and we sent it off. A little convoluted, but somehow that letter got to, through some fluke, and it was a fluke, to the Queen's diary secretary. The Queen's diary secretary showed it to Her Majesty. Her Majesty turned around and said, my father used to keep pigeons. I'm interested in that. I'm going to get involved with this. So in the proposal, it was to let birds go from Holyrood House in Edinburgh. And she said, no, I want it done from Balmoral, because I'm up here. And so get in touch with the factors of Balmoral and Sandringham, and set it up, which I did. So it came back, set it up. So we took to Balmoral weeks prior to the death, actually. Birds from across the country, I think we let loose 1,200 birds from 500 lofts across the country. And I remember talking to Robert Aiken, Brigadier Robert Aiken, CBE, Lord Lieutenant, saying to me, he had spoken to the factor at Balmoral. Oh, sorry, he was with someone who had spoken to the factor at Balmoral. And she was relating a story that when the big sort of thing took place at on the Mall and the Queen was there, the factor turned around and said, you know, Your Majesty, we're going to be letting these pigeons go and they're coming up. And she turned around and she said, I know all about it, because and I can tell you all about it, and I can tell you about birds, because my father used to keep them, my grandfather used to keep them, and went on about it. So it was completely different to everything everyone had done for the. So I'm quite proud that I was able, along with John Humphreys, who was a guy who actually whispered in my ear, could we do this? And we have. He has now written a piece about it, but it was nice to know that we had done something which Her Majesty herself actually knew about, had got involved in personally, and through God's good graces actually found out about it. Because I mean, the chances of you getting something like that ending up with the Queen is like winning a lottery, I suppose. So very, very, very honoured, and it was a tremendous race, we've had Prince Charles down when he was Prince of Wales for different things, and it's funny. I did go to Charles's wedding and various things over the years, you know. But it's all. I can tell you a little funny thing about that. Quite funny. The guy who was I don't know whether he wasn't the constable, but he was in. If you ever watch a film about Windsor, at Windsor Castle, they had a guy called Denman on there. He was in charge. Well, his lad was in Scouts with one of my kids in Scouts, and I went up to visit him because he invited me up, and it was quite funny because I turned up there. So I borrowed a company car to go up there. So I'm parked opposite St. James's, George Chapel, Windsor. So I'm parked opposite because they were in the encasements in the wall there, the buildings are. And anyhow, cut a long story short, the car battery went flat, so I had to ring the AA. And this poor guy from the AA and the AA got really funny about it. They thought I was taking the mick. And like, it's in Windsor Castle, it's by George's Chapel, yeah. And, you know, it's a company, yeah. You know, can you send somebody to start it, please? Anyway, this poor kid turned up. I always remember, the police had let him through, and he was put on his, you know, with these ties with a bit of elastic round, trying to put a tie on. And he came on, and he had his lights going, all the rest of it. And all of a sudden, this guard's office came down and sort of saluted and said, excuse me, sir, excuse me, Major, is this person with you? Alan Pinner. No. So he's doing it. Is he with you, sir? I said, yeah, he's fixing my car. The car battery's gone. Well, could you ask him to switch off his lights because he's keeping my boss up? He was like, oh, okay. And I thought this poor kid from the AA, I thought if the ground could have opened up and swallowed him, I think he would have been really grateful. But it was so, so funny. So we got the car started. Anyhow, the next thing, this guy came down and said, because Rowan Williams was my president down at the Mission to Seafarers, a great man, Rowan Williams, absolutely fantastic man. The timbre of his voice when you listen to him is unbelievable. And he came down and said, oh, of course, this Royal Highness is, and you met him in Blackwood, didn't you? It's funny how fast they can check back on things. I mean, this is a matter of hours, and I got invited to go up for the wedding, and it was quite strange, quite bizarre. But the different little things that happened, which are quite bizarre, you know, I think we're very lucky in this country in a lot of respects. The heritage, good and bad. I think the bad bits you have to learn from so it doesn't happen again, because you can't put right what has happened, but you can ensure that it doesn't happen again. And that's the most important bit for me. So I rattled on enough, sorry.
It's been absolutely fascinating to hear some of these, you know, incredible stories and some of the achievements, and, you know, being honoured in meeting many members of the royal family and your many, many achievements. You were born in the UK. Your father was born in the UK. And you mentioned some clear discrimination back in your youth and throughout growing up. Just wanted to know how that made you feel.
Made me feel that I had to work harder at everything that I did. I, for instance, my parents were very keen, and I'm exactly the same. I wouldn't go out dressed like a bag of whatever. And that wasn't being a snob or anything like that. That was, you were always having to be one step ahead, always slightly, I can't find the right words. You had to be, in my mind, you were always going to be put down, no matter what you did, so you wouldn't give them the excuse to allow them to put you down, you know. Things like, for instance, if somebody turned around and called me Chalky, it's like, and you like your teeth, you know, type of thing. You were always, I'm not racist, my best friend is black. It's like, yes, my best friend is what? What's that going to do? You know, oh, where are you from then? Well, from Pill. No, I mean originally from Pill. Yeah, where did your family come from? South Shields and Newport. And so on. So, and it was things like that drove me. I would say when it started to come on as I got older, there were times. Yeah, there were times where it did get to me. And I mean seriously, get to me. Because you lose, I wouldn't say lose faith in yourself, but you definitely lose faith in your perspective. I suppose I used to get hurt, which you always had to hide, but you'd get hurt when who you thought were friends were white, who was, if they were with their friends, would make out they hadn't seen you, or cross the road, or whatever. You would always get, does it come off? Does the colour come off? Little things like that where you were, if you then turned around and said, well, what are you talking about? Oh, you've got a chip on your shoulder. And that was a red, oh, you've got a chip on your shoulder. No, I've got a chip on my shoulder. Like, if you expect me to stand there while you call me out of my name, then you've got another thing coming. You don't know how to take a joke. Well, it's not a joke. Well, you don't really understand. I mean, it was always, you don't really understand. You've got the chip on your shoulder. You've got to allow us to take the mick out of your colour. You've got to allow us to feel superior. And I'm not trying to paint a broad brush, because they were people. They were genuine people, and there was people who would be wouldn't look on the colour. Colour wouldn't come into it. But there were other people. I remember the first girlfriend I ever had. We were very close, and there was a big. She was called to a big family thing, because if you go out with him, you have kids, you're gonna have black kids, and that's not on, you know, all these little things that went on. And that was for me where I fought and I'm fighting, because if I can carry on fighting, the kids that are coming behind me and the youngsters that are coming along now won't have to have that fight, because the fight and the solutions have been started to be sorted. So yeah, I'm all for the future. I'm all for, you know, I don't mind taking the hurt, but I'm hoping and praying that people will actually, I mean, I've worked out that in this multicultural land that we're in, sooner or later, there won't be any white or black or anything else, because of intermarriage, nobody will be able to say anything. I will never see it. Probably none of us around now will ever see it, but it will happen sooner or later. I worry that here I am at the age I am, what, 74, and we're still talking about trying to stamp out racism. The people who came from the Caribbean on Windrush, and as I said, I was involved with the mission to seafarers, and all the seafarers that have come here, made their homes here, the Somali communities and all the rest of it. You know, they came because this country needed the help and support, and people from the Caribbean and other places came to support the motherland and to support the people they thought they needed supporting. And what have they got out of it? The Windrush people are still waiting for compensation, yet we can find millions to go and buy weapons and give it away to people. We can find millions to turn around and do all kinds of, you know, executive jets for the rich and the famous and all the rest of it. But we can't find the money to give the people who deserve that money. We still talk about, when we talk about Windrush and we talk about the Caribbean, they were fighting for us long before the States came in. When we went into the war, for instance, they were in there with us straight away. Although you never see here on newsreels and documentaries and all the rest of it. About my dad in the war came back, was on the Mimans convoys and came home in completely encased in plaster because he'd been blown into the hold of the ship. You know, I'm not saying people need to be grateful, but people need to remember, you know, everyone fought for this country. It wasn't selective. Everybody fought for it, and everybody fought to build this country up afterwards. And if it wasn't for the people that came in from overseas, from the Commonwealth, and that's why I always respected the Queen. The Queen held on to the Commonwealth and held the whole concept of the Commonwealth up, and said to people, it was one of her great crowning glories, if you excuse the pun, but she was all about the Commonwealth. She understood the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth people respected her, and rightly so, because she kept the Commonwealth together, because she knew the Commonwealth was the thing that kept this place going. And we may have gone into Europe and come out of Europe and played silly people doing whatever, but at the end of the day, we've always had the Commonwealth behind us. And if something happened tomorrow, it would be the Commonwealth who would be standing shoulder to shoulder with us without exception. They may jump up and down now, but when the chips are down, they will always be there. And I just say, you know, we owe a great deal of gratefulness to those people who came and went into the NHS, who came and swept the streets, who came and drove the buses and the trains and all the rest of it, who came and actually integrated from day one and wanted to be part and parcel of this country from day one, not coming. They weren't economic migrants, they weren't boat people, they were people who came here to help make this country a place for heroes, as they said, to live. Well, but we're still fighting for the recognition, and that's wrong.
So finally, with the colourful picture you've painted about racism and the importance of diversity, if you were given the opportunity to make permanent changes, what would they be?
I would have an open conversation about racism with young people today so that they understood. I'm not talking about jumping up and down and making slogans, all the rest of it, but to have a conversation about young people with well, not necessarily young, all age groups, about why do you feel this way? What makes somebody different? If somebody is of a different colour, why does that make such a big difference? If someone has got their legs blown off, they're still human beings. So what is the trigger that makes it? I'm one of the, my hats is deputy chair of governors in a hugely ethically mixed school. Those children speak Welsh and there's white, black, brown. They are all friends. So what is, so therefore it's got to be the parents who drive the kids. So for me, we've got to start talking to the kids. So when they become the parents, they're not breeding that into them. So that's what I would do if I had this wand. When the day that when people turn around and say at the end of the day, it's a, you know, this land, this world, at the end of the day, we've all got the same colour blood and we all end up in the same place.
It's been absolutely fascinating speaking with you today, and I feel privileged to be in your company as the Queen was. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
Nothing other than, you know, for me, if someone learns something or can take away from anything that I've said, what I think they need to remember is no matter how much strife, no matter how much you can feel uncomfortable, no matter how much you can hurt, providing you can, there's got to, always going to be someone you can talk to and confide in and talk it through, and you should do that. And the other thing is, be proud. The big thing about everything is, immaterial of everybody else, feel proud of yourself and have that pride in yourself. Because at the end of the day, it's all about you, and it's not about other people and what they think, it's what you think of you.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated.